This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The end is near. Governor Bev Perdue will give up her office to Governor-elect Pat McCrory on January 5th. Her tenure as governor was historic, if for no other reason than she was the first female to take the executive position in North Carolina. It was also tumultuous. She took office during a historic economic crisis. Halfway through her term, the state legislature was taken over by the GOP. You combine that with a number of scandals in the state's Democratic Party, and Perdue's once rising star faded fast. Finally, she announced she would not seek re-election just 15 weeks before the May primaries. Walter Dalton picked up the baton and eventually lost to Republican Pat McCrory in the November election. As we say goodbye to Governor Perdue, we want to take a look back at her 4 years and what she's accomplished, what was left undone. Joining us to talk about her legacy, our News and Observer political reporter, Rob Christensen. Rob, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Also on the program, Scott Mooneyham, editor of The Insider, a North Carolina state government news service. Scott, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank.
And we're taking your phone calls and emails. What do you think Governor Bev Perdue's legacy was? How do you think she did? Are you looking forward to the McCrory administration? 877-962-9862, SOT at WUNC.org, if you want to join the conversation. So, Rob, I'm going to get both of your takes here, but I'll start with you. Overall, how would you assess those past 4 years for Bev Perdue?
Well, you get always into these questions about whether a public official makes history or is a sort of history makes the person. And I think she really was affected by the times. And I think you're exactly right. If you look at her governorship, it was really two huge events affected her that really didn't affect any governor. She had the deepest recession of any governor since the 1930s, and that really affected her first 2 years. And then her final 2 years was she had a Republican legislature, which no governor had since the 1800s. And those were the two overriding factors that impacted her governorship. And so no matter who would have been governor, despite her whatever her political strengths and weaknesses are, they totally dominated her governorship and what she could accomplish. So she didn't have any money to spend. So she couldn't have any major initiatives as governor. It totally constrained her about what she could do. In her first 2 years when governors typically have their initiatives. And then the last 2 years, she played defense. She was playing defense against Republican initiatives who had a totally different view of what government looked like. And then, but beyond that, beyond being constrained by these historical shifts that were going on, you know, did she do everything she could? And the answer is, I think probably not. She was not a particularly gifted political figure in a lot of ways. She had a difficult time articulating a vision. I think part of that is she came out of the legislature. That was her political background. She was 14 years in the legislature, lieutenant governor, and she was the first. And this is an important point. I think she was the first legislator. A governor who came out of the legislature since Jim Holzhauser in 1972. And legislators are very good at things like cutting deals and making compromises, but they're not very good in terms of public relations and going around the state and selling their programs. And she had a hard time making, I think, that transition from legislator to executive. And then she also, I think, had a hard time. She was not particularly quick on her feet. She tended to put her foot in her mouth sometimes. We can remember a few occasions of that happened, and so she was not particularly good at presenting herself as a chief executive role.
Scott,
well, I agree with Rob that certainly she, politicians are always to some degree defined by the events around them, but. Some of them are overwhelmed by them, and she was to a degree. She was overwhelmed by the Great Recession. It's interesting, though, that Rob also talked about the Republican legislature, and when 2 years into her term, she was faced with this, shift in the legislature. And there were a lot of people at that time that thought she might actually benefit from a Republican legislature. Her public standing might benefit from a Republican legislature because she would have a foil, something to play against. And if you recall, there were early on, she vetoed several of the bills that came out of the Republican legislature. There was some thought, and maybe there was a slight uptick in the polls in her standing in the public, but it didn't seem to last. And it's interesting. I guess political scientists will debate this forever, but you know why she wasn't able to continue to turn that to her advantage, that she was standing up to this Republican legislature, and that I think naturally a governor has veto power. When she exercises that veto power, that is a statement of strength. But in a lot of cases, particularly when you are of an opposing party of the legislature, but it didn't seem to. Maybe part of that is because a lot of those vetoes were overridden.
Right. I mean, that's it. It's a show of strength when you win, but then you're really proving your overall weakness if you're losing. 877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation, looking at the legacy of Governor Bev Perdue. Well, how much of the inability to, say, take advantage of this dichotomy, this chance to distinguish yourself over and against a Republican legislature, Rob, would you say, and I'll ask you too, Scott, is just not being in the habit, not being conditioned. The fact that Democrats had been in charge for so long, McCrory, the first Democrat, a Republican in 20 years, you go back to the 19th century to find a time when you've had a split, you know, the governor's mansion and the legislature. There's just no habit. There's no culture of dealing with opposition. Was that any part of what happened here?
Well, I think that's a good point, Frank. I think that Democrats had a difficult time adjusting to their new role, but I think a more sure-footed political leader could have adopted that role. I think I'm going to go back to an earlier point. Is that Governor Perdue, if you look at her polling numbers, when she came into office, she was not particularly popular when she came in. You know, governors usually come in, and Pat McCrory's coming in, with, as most governors do, with an approval rating of over 50%. Pretty typical of governors. Bev Perdue came in. She was only at 40%. So she did not come in as a particularly popular figure, and she was in part helped by President Obama's strong showing here in the state. So she didn't have a strong reservoir support in the first place. And so when the Great Recession hit and she had to make all these tough decisions, she helped push through a tax increase. They had furloughs. They had to make all these budget cuts and everything. She just really took a hit. And by July of her first year, her approval rating was down to 25%, and she never recovered from that. And the only time it ever even came up to 40% was after Hurricane Irene in September of 2011. So the first impressions were lasting impressions for her. And she was never able to recover from the first impression, which was a bad impression. So she angered conservatives by raising taxes. She angered liberals by some of the cuts in budget cuts and by furloughs of state employees and so forth. And she was never able to recover from the first initial reaction. And I think that was a very, very powerful thing.
Well, go ahead, Scott.
Well, I'll just add that she, you know, no one in that position, and particularly facing the circumstances that she faced, is going to make everybody happy. But Rob mentioned furloughs and tax increases, and often she would say things which indicated that she was going to take strong, decisive actions, and then she didn't. And I think that ultimately people want to see strong leadership in the governor. And too often it was a combination of her words and her actions. If she wouldn't quite follow through on what she said she was going to do.
Well, let's pull back a little bit from the governor and take a look at the Democratic Party and reexamine this question of the kind of indolence, maybe, of power, having power for so long. Why does the Democratic Party not see the writing on the wall? Doesn't it have more charismatic candidates? You remember, it was a very close election with Pat McCrory in 2008 with a huge, enthusiastic Democratic outpouring for the president. And everybody thought, well, how did she get that close with so much support for the the president. So it seems that the Democrats didn't have a good candidate going in. Why not?
Well, it's an interesting question, and I think that the Democrats for so long have relied on the legislature to produce these candidates for higher office. And as Rob said, maybe as we're going forward, perhaps in our state's history, maybe that's not the best body to produce the charismatic candidate, the candidate that people really see as a strong leader going forward. And now we've got this governor coming into office who becomes really the first metropolitan governor, metropolitan mayor to become governor. And maybe that sets the stage for this to continue to happen in the future.
I think the way to look at it is it was amazing that the Democrats were able to have 20 years of Democratic governors. That's the longest run of Democratic governors anywhere east of the Rockies in an increasingly Republican South. So I think, you know, in a closely divided state, I think it was really almost unexplainable that they were able to do it that long. And so it's really, one would have expected that the Democratic run would have ended.
877-962-9862, the number to call as our conversation continues on the legacy of Bev Perdue. Scott Mooneyham's here. He's the editor of Insider, a North Carolina State Government News Service, News and Observer political reporter Rob Christensen, and your calls at 877-962-9862. When the State of Things continues from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about the legacy of Governor Bev Perdue. With us, News and Observer political reporter Rob Christensen, and Scott Mooneyham is editor of The Insider, a North Carolina State Government News Service. Taking your phone calls as well at 877-962-9862 or emails at sot@wunc.org. Rob, she also inherited from the Democratic Party political scandals that surrounded her as she took office. What impact did that have, do you think, on her?
Well, I think it had a cumulative effect. I mean, she sort of came up through the good old boy system of Democratic politics. She came up through the legislature. Some of it came back to haunt her. There were reports of her, of course, interfering with the highway patrol and promoting various people within the patrol, which is a very old way the system have worked in politics. And, you know, in the last few weeks we had a big Democratic Party fundraiser who had gotten in some trouble having a bridge named after him down in Wilmington. That's sort of the old system that she came up from, Eastern North Carolina. And of course, there were some of her campaign in 2008. She had three members of her campaign staff or supporters that were indicted. So she had all that kind of history going in there, but she her own administration was fairly clean. I mean, she got pretty high level. Her own cabinet was very well thought of, and in fact, she tried to put some distance between herself and some of the scandals that occurred with Mike Easley former Speaker Jim Black and former Agriculture Commissioner Meg Scott Phipps. And she actually had some pretty good reforms that most of the good government groups gave her pretty high plaudits for. Yeah. But that was when, such as, for example, the Department of Transportation, she took some of the politics out of road building, that sort of thing. So she actually tried to clean up government to a certain extent, but it was very difficult because she coming into office, she was of that system, and also she was not entirely clean herself.
Yeah,
her campaign.
Some things going on. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I'm not sure how much the public really, certainly among the Republican core voter, they weren't going to vote for Beverly Perdue anyway. When you look at the actual scandal as it touched her, it was the issue that she had to answer to were these campaign plane flights that were not listed on her campaign finance form. You know, you could go back and look at, I think you could go back in history and look at any number of candidates and find similar instances like that.
It's not the same as taking a satchel of money in the men's room.
That's correct. Yeah. And it's campaign flights. It was not a personal benefit as Mike Easley, the allegations and ultimately that led to his plea in court. She did not benefit personally. And so I'm just not sure how much that really damaged her among the larger electorate. And particularly when you consider, if you look at what has happened to campaign finance during these 4 years she's been in office, it's the Wild Wild West out there. Mm-hmm. And so, she could have done the same things. Her campaign could have done the same things legally today that she kind of ran into trouble with.
Let's go to the phones right now. Randy is on the line from Pittsburgh. Hello, Randy.
Hello, Frank. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Co-chair of Governor Perdue's campaign in Chatham County, we should add, in 2008. And you'd like to comment on her legacy.
Well, Frank, I think that her legacy, all the comments that have been made are well-made comments. I think her legacy remains to be written. It depends on what happens here in the last couple of weeks. If the governor decides to pardon the Wilmington 10, for instance, her legacy will be seen in one light. And if she doesn't, it'll be seen in another. But I think that Bev got her sea legs going and took some very strong stands on vetoing some legislation that was courageous. And I felt that is a part of her legacy.
All right. Well, let's get some comment on that, Randy. We talked a little bit, but go ahead, Scott, on the vetoes.
It's interesting when you talk about legacy versus history, and certainly every governor to some degree makes history. I think one of the things that people kind of forget, and part of her legacy is going to be as not as governor, but as lieutenant governor, in that she, as the presiding officer in the Senate, she broke the tie in the lottery vote. Would the lottery have happened without that? Republicans have probably unfairly criticized this Dick's Land deal. But I think they are correct that she is certainly looking to establish a legacy in trying to preserve that property for the public long term.
You know, you go to a Democratic rally and Governor Perdue is cheered for having vetoed the voter ID bill or vetoed legislation that would put the state on record in a legal fight against Obamacare, that sort of thing. So even when those vetoes were overridden, in some cases they were not in the case of voter ID, she was standing up for the principles of the Democratic Party, and that made her a heroine within the Democratic Party. And I'm always reminded of a Republican Senator Jesse Helms, who often, when he was in the Senate and the Democrats were in control of the Senate, he would stand up and fight for conservative principles, and that made him a hero in conservative circles. And even when he wasn't winning, he was becoming a hero in conservative circles for making a statement and fighting the good fight. And so I think that's true now in the past couple of years. Democrats cheered even when she was losing, standing up for what they viewed as the principles of fight against the Republicans.
And it will be interesting in hindsight. She also vetoed the effort to move forward in fracking. Mm-hmm. We will do that now. So in hindsight, depending on the ecological effects of that, we could be looking back again saying, what a hero, if only we had listened, possibly, or then again, maybe not. So that's, I think, Ron's point about history. You have to take the long view. What does a veto of fracking mean if fracking doesn't do anything to the state? But if it causes great damage, then we say, well, what a hero. Let's take an email here. Paula Wolf, a political operative here in the state in Raleigh, who says, Governor-elect McCrory has just appointed Art Pope to his cabinet. She says Bev Perdue looks like a dream by comparison. Well, we might expect that from a Democratic operative, Paula Wolf. And thank you for the email. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's move to, because we talked about the difficulty in trying to be the executive with the opposition party in charge, Governor Perdue, over and against the Republican legislature last 2 years of her tenure. What about Pat McCrory working with a Republican legislature? Will that be easy for him, do you think, Scott?
I don't think so at all. To some degree, a Democratic governor interacting with a Republican legislature is to some degree predictable. A Republican governor interacting with a Republican legislature, I think, is less predictable, because what Pat McCrory has to worry about is being boxed in. He has to appeal to a statewide electorate. He can't, as these legislators can do, go run and hide in their safe districts. I think he's very well aware of that, though. But it is going to be very interesting to see how he negotiates and treads down that path to not be boxed in by the initiatives of this legislature that certainly a lot of Democrats see as moving more and more to the right and not in step with kind of the moderate history of the state.
Well, I think that's right. I think McCrory does not want the Republican Party, now that they're in total control of all three branches of state government, to be portrayed as the Tea Party Republican Party. He wants it to be a modern, broader-based Republican Party. But that's not how it's viewed by everybody in the Republican Party, and certainly not everybody in the legislature. And so there's going to be a tug and pull there that's going on, and that's not going to be easy. Plus, there's a real learning curve here for the governor, for governor-elect McCrory. He's new to Raleigh. He's never served here. There's a whole lot to learn, and the legislature, the legislative leadership is well versed in Raleigh. So they're starting out with a tremendous knowledge of state government and state politics, and governor-elect McCrory is the new guy on the block.
You both suggest that he'll have to do a bit of a tap dance to keep from being pulled too far to the right, and yet what is the appointment of Art Pope, good friends with the Koch brothers, founders of the Tea Party? This is what do you make of that?
Well, for one thing, I don't know what to make of it because I'm just learning of it right now. I would say this is that it does bring into his administration somebody with very broad knowledge of state government. Art Pope served in the Martin administration. He served in the legislature. He's a very good numbers guy. And he brings somebody with broad credibility within the Republican Party. So McCrory sends Art Pope over to talk to the legislators to calm them down on a particular issue, I'm sure he'll have their voice.
Scott?
Well, as Rob said, in fact, we were both driving over here, I guess, while this appointment was being announced. So we're just learning of it. Certainly, one thing that it will do is that email shows, Democrats in this state are not likely to be happy about it at all, and they are going to then view actions taken by the administration through that prism,
yeah.
And he's going to the new governor will have to some degree answer to that.
He was appointed, by the way, deputy budget director the appointment, but go ahead.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, the one thing I like about it is that, you know, you talk about all these people talk about shadow government and billionaires working behind the shadows. Well, here it's all out in the open.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. There's accountability.
There's transparency here.
When Governor Perdue ran and early on in her tenure, she talked about building this economy around the military. We have a strong military presence in this state. Why not invite contractors into the state? And that can be the basis of a sound economy. Now, through this recession, military spending didn't fall at all. Why was she not successful? That seems to me like a kind of a dream proposition for someone who wants to not suffer as much during the Great Recession.
Well, I think that whether you're talking about military contractors, whether you're talking about business of any type in terms of luring it to the state, states, governors have limits on what they can do, and mostly what they try to do is use tax incentives of some type to try to lure that business here. And this governor, as we've already mentioned, was faced with this staggering recession and its effects on limiting the revenue that she had to spend on those types of initiatives that might have been in which she might have been able to lure military contractors to the state. And, you know, I remember talking to her just before she took office. And I think besides that, I think she did expect that she was going to be able to do things to improve small business in this state and encourage entrepreneurship. And she just was never able to do those things.
I want to go to the phones now. Kelly is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, and I'm sorry I got dropped, so I missed the beginning of that last thing. But it was my question or my comment, and that was, I guess I disagree with that last statement, and I was calling to ask everybody to consider some of the initiatives that maybe didn't reach the height of the media hype, but my concern was about the North Carolina Military Foundation, which she launched as a lieutenant governor, but has since gone on to become, you know, a standalone organization. It's an economic business development that is privately funded, led by military leaders, and they have created a lot of opportunities for both small and big businesses and universities within North Carolina through partnerships and development and innovation. And, you know, as I was speaking to the woman that answered the phone earlier, my point was, you know, she has created a partnership, or it has created a partnership with NASCAR that will ensure safety and efficiency of soldiers and Marines, while at the same time giving NASCAR and the motorsports industry of North Carolina an additional bandwidth, if you would. So I think that, you know, I wish that people, as we're talking about legacy, would think about some of the economic initiatives, small and big, that she has put forth that have worked well.
All right. Well, thank
and that maybe have gotten lost in the larger picture.
All right, Kelly, thank you for the call. Thanks very much. Rob?
Well, I think the caller makes a very good point. I think there actually were a number of initiatives that did not get a lot of attention from Governor Perdue, that in part because for some reason or other she was not particularly good at tooting her horn. I think she, for example, some of her background in private life was in gerontology, for example. And she was very good at promoting programs for the aging. This is a population that is aging, a lot of baby boomers, a lot of retirees here. And she was very good at pushing various agencies to see how they could connect on issues of aging and getting elderly populations involved and how does state government prepare for that. And so she put a whole lot of effort in her 4 years in how to deal with the aging population. Got very little publicity, very little attention, but that's an important issue that's facing the state. And she was, in part because of her own particular background as an individual, stressed that.
Scott?
Frank, she also she was able to establish some initiatives to encourage green jobs and some of the environmental service industries as well. But I think you have to acknowledge, and some of that has been successful, but I think you have to acknowledge that in a number of things, these things, she was not able to do them on the grand scale that she had originally envisioned.
Or publicize.
Yes.
877, pardon me, 877-962-9862. So will history look more favorably, do you think, on Bev Perdue than we are in the moment?
Well, her place in history, first of all, is going to be there because she was the first woman. So that alone will mean she's going to be more than a footnote. And then because she was governor during these two big historical trends, the Great Recession and the Republican takeover of the legislature, that will ensure her place in history. Now, whether she'll go down as a particularly distinguished governor remains to be seen, but she will certainly go down as a historical first, and as a governor who was there during historically consequential times.
Scott, do you think her gender played a role in her perception as governor?
Yes. I mean, I think that that happens regardless of whether it's fair or not. I think the electorate has different perceptions about female and male politicians in high profile positions. I hope I'm not offending anybody, but I think that is just the political reality. And I think the electorate likes to see women politicians in particular show that they are strong and decisive. I think men can get away sometimes, maybe more so, with kind of testing the political winds than a woman can in those positions.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Scott Mooneyham is editor of The Insider, a North Carolina state government news service. Rob Christensen, political reporter for The News and Observer in Raleigh. Thank you both so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Glad to do it.
Coming up, a look at UNC's beat-making lab. Stay tuned.